Hello and welcome along once again to the show. This champing at the bit to report on all issues relating to media and communications without going simply to the likes of that, which is so eloquently dubbed a scandal. I'm Mick Caldwell. Welcome along to the Fourth Estate, Community Radio's weekly foray into all issues that govern our communications industry. Today on the show, we review our auntie in terms of in-house TV production with the passing of an iconic birthday for one of our most loved TV shows. Also on the show, we investigate independence in government-based advertising about that carbon tax with no-holds-barred reportage on all things that matter. To find out, stay tuned to the Fourth Estate. James and Rupert Murdoch faced a humble moment before the Parliamentary Committee in the United Kingdom, facing up to these issues that have arisen from the phone hacking scandal. In particular, questions around the culture of the Murdoch media and knowledge of payments to people linked with criminal activity were met with denial. Closer to home, the scrutiny is surrounding how indeed The Australian is reporting on these issues, with the paper belonging to the News Limited Group. Nathan Coates decided to investigate further. Professor Alan Knight is the head of journalism at the University of Technology Sydney, and Nathan Coates is a journalism student at UTS as well as our Fourth Estate reporter. Not venturing into these ideas lightly, this is the first of two parts about the issues that have arisen from this scandal.
In the Culture Committee, a term was brought up, willful blindness, which apparently arose from the Enron investigation.
Yes, I heard it was interesting, wasn't it?
willful blindness potentially being a principle underpinning the Murdoch culture.
Well, I watched the Murdoch performance, and I found the Sergeant Schultz defence really interesting. There used to be a program called Hagen's Heroes, and Sergeant Schultz always used to say, "I know nothing, 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 I know nothing." And essentially that kept ringing in my ears as I was watching the Murdochs. I mean, clearly it was a carefully prepared response which they made, and essentially they seemed to seemed to be very large amounts of money moving around within the organisation, which the senior executives apparently didn't know about. Now, perhaps that's true. And if what they say is true, I think it raises serious questions about the level of the quality of governance within the News Corporation itself.
In response to the content of discussions that Rupert Murdoch might have with his editors, he said, quote, "What's doing?" Is that becoming of a CEO of a news corporation?
Yeah, Murdoch's always operated like that. If you actually read the things that have been written about him over the last 30-odd years, Hugh Lunn wrote a really good book called Working for Rupert, and he described the way, what would happen when Murdoch lobbed into Australia. You know, he said it was terrifying because Murdoch used to seem to know exactly what you'd been doing and what you hadn't done. And he described the executives responding like a herd of panicked gazelles, you know, sometimes jumping to their own destruction. So certainly Murdoch used to have a very close and intimate knowledge of what his journalists were doing. Now, if you take what he said when he was talking to the British Parliamentary Committee, it would seem that that's no longer the case.
Reportage of News of the World in the Australian press has some quantitative issues amongst the tabloids. It's underreported in the Daily Telegraph. What about the qualitative issues amongst the broadsheets? You did an interview on the BBC yesterday in which you highlighted the differences between the Australian reportage and the Sydney Morning Herald reportage. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, what it was that the Australian basically appeared to be significant differences. The way that the photograph that was used, it was the same topic. It was the Murdochs appearing before the committee. The Australian had the photograph showed Rupert touching the arm of his son, looking quite concerned. And on reviewing that, that was actually the time when he delivered the message about being humble, which sounded really like something a PR person suggested he should say. In the background, Wendy Dung was looking concerned. The Herald had a different approach. It actually had the same grouping, but both Murdoch and both the Murdochs looked worried. So there was actually a message in the way those photographs have been selected. I haven't got the exact wording in front of me, but in fact the Herald stressed about how they were ashamed, and there was and talked about the scandal. The Australian began, and its lead sentence was about Murdoch's claim that in fact a whole lot of this had been stirred up by competitors within Britain. Once again, that's an interesting view. I haven't done a study on, and it would be very useful to do a content analysis, looking at how precisely this issue was actually covered.
I think the Conversation is undertaking that study at the moment.
Yeah, well, there you go. I'd be interested to see the outcomes. But until that's done, I couldn't say for certain. But certainly, look, I mean, we know that in the past, that in fact, criticism of the Murdoch family has not featured highly in News Corporation newspapers. You know, it's just not there, you know. And
Is that a problem? I guess when Rupert Murdoch or News Limited owns 70% of the Australian press.
Well, you've just answered your own question. It's not a problem that they've got an opinion. It's not a problem that they make decisions about what they'll run and what they can't run or won't run. That's up to them. It is a problem when, in fact, there are no alternatives.
Payment for stories, is that ethical and legitimate journalistic practice?
Well, it happens, and you have to really treat it case by case. You know, sometimes the story is so important that there may be no other way to get the information. I mean, you make a judgment on on the public interest.
Do you think it's credible that neither James or Rupert Murdoch were aware of large payments to people linked with the phone hacking scandal?
Well, that's what they say. If they're not, that indicates, in my view, that raises really serious questions about corporate governance within News Corp.
Why do you think UK Prime Minister David Cameron asked Rupert Murdoch to enter number 10 Downing Street through the back door for their meeting following Cameron's election victory?
You'd have to ask him, but essentially one of the ways that News Corp have operated over a very long period is through the endorsing of select politicians. For example, Murdoch endorsed Tony Blair, and Tony Blair was an invited speaker at their annual conference of editors. So it depends on who News Corp was supporting at the time. Why they used the back door? Well, you'd have to ask the Prime Minister that.
Jay Rosson from New York University Journalism commented that News Corp is not a news company at all, but a global media empire that employs its newspapers and in the US Fox News as a lobbying arm.
Well, I'm glad Jay actually picked up on my article in The Age and also what I've written previously. Yes, of course, that's obviously true in the sense that newspapers now are a very small part of the News Corp business. News Corp, among other things, is 20th Century Fox. It actually publishes music. It publishes literature. It's got a book publishing company. It's actually got interest on the internet. It's a vast, cross-transnational, vertically and horizontally integrated business of which news is part of the cultural package. And Rosen is right, but I've been arguing this for a number of years. I mean, essentially, you cannot see a news corporation as simply as a news organisation. And it cross-promotes. So in actual fact, the movies that it makes are you know, written about in its newspapers. The stars are interviewed on its television stations. You know, things about them go on the websites. The music, the musical themes are actually published, and the actual scripts are published as books. You know, it all fits together, and that's part of their corporate strategy, and has been for quite a number of years. Murdoch describes this as a model for 21st century media organisations.
Professor Alan Knight is the head of journalism at UTS, as well as the former head of the Friends of the ABC, which leads in nicely to our next story.
There's a bear in there, and a chair as well.
Let's take a look through the oblong window and get out those paper-friendly scissors to commemorate the iconic TV learning facility.
It's Play School.
There's Play School on the advent of its 45th anniversary on TV. They might not look a day older than when the pilot first aired, but the collective gang of toys that have typified our childhood alongside Benita, George and that controversial Noni Hazelhurst, who recently spiced up Storytime under the rocket clock with an explicit message inciting children to go to sleep. And with all the changes and developments that continue to transform the taxpayer-funded broadcaster, there have been some serious doubts relayed over whether the gang will crack the half century. Ever since the appointment of the head of TV's Kim Dalton in 2006. Play School is produced entirely from within the ABC compound, and it has been from day one. But many believe Dalton is intent on imparting an agenda to phase out this local production, already dismissing some 30-odd in-house producers. Will Jemima, Big Ted and all the gang face middle age out on the street? Annie Wiley opened wide to come inside with former broadcaster Darcy Cassidy, part of the political group Friends of the ABC.
Kim Dalton at the ABC has been pushing for a move to having less in-house production for about 5 years now. But what does this mean for iconic Australian shows like Play School, which is now in its 45th year and still going very strong?
I think it's a threat to the independence of the ABC and to the diversity of ABC productions. This is not to say that the ABC should not outsource any production, but I think it has been important that the ABC retains its own production capacity and is not at the mercy of external producers. People like Dalton have long argued that it's more efficient to use the so-called independent production sector. But I question the use of the word independent. I think it's more correct to describe it as the commercial production centre. And the ABC, of course, is meant to be a public service broadcaster, and I worry about the ABC losing its independence, losing its capacity to make major productions internally.
On that note of commercialising, something like Play School, it seems to have a format that is, it couldn't be pulled off by another production trying to do a similar thing, especially in this age of Bratz Dolls and Ben 10 and, you know, a much sort of older level of children's programming. So do you think that this commercialisation, which essentially what it would be, would mean that shows formatted in this way might be lost forever?
I think there's a worry, you know, it's not impossible that a private production house could produce such a program, but it's less likely. They tend to be caught up in their own world, in their own worldview, and the likelihood of them coming up with the sort of material that the ABC comes up with internally is less so. We've tended to see the commercial production sector, you know, caught up in fashions, in particular genres, and the actual creative ability that they once had, and I think it's true to say that a lot of those early small production houses were innovative. But as time has gone by, they've grown, they've become much more like businesses, They're no longer like artist collectives. They're much more like businesses.
So do you think that by using private contractors, the ABC will have more tune-in-once sort of viewers as opposed to regular watchers who will tune in for generations?
I don't know if it'd go that directly, but I think there's a danger that the ABC loses its distinctiveness if it is not able to produce its own material in-house. If you give up the major production facilities you have, if you give up those people that have been with the ABC for many years and they're all just absorbed into the external world, then I think you give up that special or a deal of that special ABC look and feel.
Besides revenue, what are the reasons behind downsizing productions?
The argument has been that internal production is expensive in the sense that you may have to maintain production facilities like large studios, camera crews, and so forth that you can't use all the time. That if you're only using a facility 7 months of the year, you're wasting those 5 months of all that equipment, all those buildings and sitting there. And there's an element of truth in that. But I think that the way around that is to use a mixed model, to continue to use external producers, but to have your own capacity internally, so you've always got your own independence, your own style, your own distinctiveness. Once you give up all of your capacity to produce internally, you're stuck with having to go outside all the time. And what we've tended to see in Australia is that the external production companies, which started off as being fairly small-scale, which started off as being quite innovative, they get taken over by the major corporations. The sort of material that those commercial production houses can produce are being produced on Channel 10, Channel 9 and Channel 7. We're looking to the ABC to have a different style, and I fear that'll be lost if it no longer has the capacity to go it alone and you know, do its own thing.
Spelling it out for Annie Wiley, Darce Cassidy was giving us the ABC to Play School's monumental 45th anniversary. Cross Community Radio, you're tuned into the Media and Communications program known as the Fourth Estate. And if you've just tuned in, you've got to the juicy bits as we now investigate the role of one journalist for News Limited paper, The Australian, Caroline Overington, lashed out at critics of the Murdoch Press. One particular article, titled Rivals Get Facts Wrong in Gloating, questions the integrity of some individuals and organisations who have analysed the News of the World fiasco. A large portion of her criticism was levelled at Professor Alan Knight, the head of journalism at the University of Technology, Sydney. Nathan Coates spoke further to Knight about the issues that have been raised by Overington's article.
Alan, you wrote an opinion piece in The Age on July 12 that critically analysed both contenders seeking the contract to operate the Australian network, being Sky News and the ABC. Australian reporter Caroline Overington criticised you and others for reporting on a range of matters pertaining to News Limited and Rupert Murdoch. You're aware of the criticism. How would you summarise your response?
Well, in the article I wrote, I wasn't very friendly towards the Australian Television Network and the way it operated at all. I described the ABC's management of it as pedestrian, and I suggested that, if there was a scale of judging international television broadcasters on the basis of content, well, the heaviest hitters would be the BBC and Al Jazeera, and the weakest, at the bottom of the scale, would be Chinese state television and the Australian network.
Caroline Overington pointed at the possibility of some conflict of interest. She mentioned that the study was commissioned and paid for by the Australian network. The study was conducted by the ACIJ, so the Australian Centre for Independent Journalism, which you're a former director of.
That's right. I was a director of the ACIJ by memory 1992.
Did you receive any payment for the study?
No.
Despite criticising the ABC, your position as a national spokesperson for Friends of the ABC was mentioned. Are you still national spokesperson for the Friends
I did it for a year in 2007. And I did it because I believe in public broadcasting as an alternative to a newspaper system which is heavily dominated by News Corp. And one other thing I should point out, it's really important if you're talking about the criticism of The Australian, that essentially I was critical of Australian Network. They weren't worried about that, but what they did was Carol Noble appeared to do was discredit me for being a friend of the ABC. I mean, it's an almost absurd proposition. You know, you write an article which attacks both groups, and then you're attacked for actually a conflict of interest because you're supposed to be favourable to one.
Are you aware that Caroline Overington was reported in 2007 to have written an email to a candidate for the seat of Wentworth, Danielle Acuah, explicitly urging Acuah to preference Liberal candidate Malcolm Turnbull?
I've seen the wiki entries on her work, yes.
Do you have any comment on that?
I think her work is a matter for her own conscience.
Are you aware that, according to Caroline Overington, this was done in the context of creating a, quote, great front page, given the Labor candidate George Newhouse was an ex-partner of Acuah?
I'm aware of that whole dispute, and I think at this stage it's not appropriate for me to actually get into Overington's behaviour as a journalist. I think that's a matter for the Media Alliance Judiciary Committees, Ethics Committees, and for own employers.
Caroline Overington wrote in her column Media Diary that upon contacting Fairfax, your piece was pulled. I went to the Age website last night and read your article. Are you aware of the story being pulled from the Age website at any time?
Yeah, when they received criticism like that, they did pull it off to actually have a look at it, and I had a discussion with them and it went back up.
How long was it pulled for?
I have no idea.
You described the Australian Network as being ABC rather light and being on par with Chinese television in terms of political reportage. Are you aware of the ABC publishing or broadcasting a criticism of you or your article?
Oh, they could do, but the ABC is such a diverse organisation. Yeah, it's possible, but I don't know.
What would you say to the comment that Caroline Overington's writing on your article is more about using the Australian newspaper to lobby for news limited interests rather than it is about robust and balanced criticism?
You'd have to ask her that.
Professor Alan Knight, Head of Journalism at UTS, who was weighing it up with Nathan Coates. Big thanks, of course, to the financial support that is provided to us by the University of Technology Sydney's Humanities and Social Sciences Department, as well as the Faculty of Arts at Macquarie University. The government's new advertising campaign in support of the carbon tax has kicked off, and Tony Abbott is crying foul. The opposition leader says that the Labor Party should pay for the ads and not expect the taxpayer to foot the bill because it's not about the facts. But despite years of complaints about government advertising from the public, and politicians of all stripes, it seems there's little appetite in the Parliament for tightening up the rules, as Tim Roxburgh reports.
Across Australia, people like Reed are already working to create a clean energy future. But a carbon price will help us do more.
Well, in this country, we've seen a lot of exploitation of government advertising for partisan purposes, and that's been going on for a long time, both at the federal level and at the state levels.
Dr. Sally Young is a senior lecturer in political science at the University of Melbourne. She says that government advertising is increasingly for purposes other than educating the public about the factual detail of government policy.
Governments have, in Australia, increasingly used it for more emotive messages and trying to counter public perceptions and trying to change public opinion rather than giving factual information.
How do you feel when you hear the opposition saying that the Labor Party, instead of the taxpayer, should foot the bill for these ads? You must have heard that same complaint from both sides of politics so many times over the last decade, and yet neither side of politics seemed to have come up with a serious policy to put a stop to it.
They have come up with serious policies, but they do so when they're in opposition. And as soon as they're in government, they either don't implement what they've promised, and John Howard did that Several state premiers did that. The Rudd and Gillard government have done that as well. It's very common. It's almost inevitable, really. If you watch politics over many years, you see that when they're in opposition and they're hurting because the government's spending a lot of money on advertising, they put forward all sorts of schemes and suggestions about how they would address this once they get in. And then once they get in and they see the possibilities, it's just too tempting and they end up doing the same thing themselves.
Deputy Leader of the Greens, Christine Milne, says that this advertising campaign is justified because the opposition leader is spreading misinformation across the country.
When you've got somebody who is reckless and telling the community absolute lies in the case of some of the things that are being said about increased pricing, then you've got to come to the point of saying surely the government has a responsibility to tell people who is going to be paying the carbon price, how it will be passed through, and how communities will be assisted in meeting those extra charges.
Opposition leader Tony Abbott has said that the Labor Party should be paying for the ads that have started promoting the government's climate change policies, not the taxpayer. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't, and that's the ultimate hypocrisy from Tony Abbott, because the Howard government was one of the absolute worst in the history of the federal parliament for spending taxpayers' money. The question is, should this campaign be held? Yes, I believe it should, because I think it's in the public interest. The important thing is to make sure that it's a fact-based campaign, that it is information, and that it is not being put out there as a party political message. And I believe that the advertising that is going out does come into that category, and it has been approved through the processes that the government has set up their own independent committee.
Now, there are some of these ads, though, that are quite emotive in their content rather than fact-based. And that committee process that the approval of these ads has gone through has been something that's been criticised by you in the past.
Yes, that's right. And the Greens' position has always been that the advertising should go to the Auditor-General. And we introduced, Senator Brown in particular, introduced a private member's bill to that effect. But that hasn't been debated in the federal parliament nor agreed, and that is the Greens' position. But we also agree that there is a strong argument for putting information into the public arena, and I think the Prime Minister's right when she says that everywhere she's been in the last week, people are asking for information. That's certainly been my experience.
Surely, though, the issue, though, of whether or not the opposition leader might be outright lying through his teeth is separate to the one about how these advertising campaigns should be approved. And wouldn't the community expect by now, given that both you and the opposition are opposed to the present system, that maybe you could have gotten together and got something done about this?
Well, we can't do more than introduce legislation into the Senate and try to get it on the list to be debated. Suffice to say, Tim, that you're right. The Greens think that this needs to go to the Auditor-General, but we've never heard the Coalition thinking that that was a good idea, nor have we had them apologising to the Australian people about the amount of money that they used in which they now admit was not public interest but was political advertising.
Deputy Leader of the Greens, Christine Milne, ending that report. Produced by Tim Roxburgh. And loosening the belt slightly, that brings us to the end of this week's episode of The Fourth Estate. Don't forget, you can always subscribe to our podcast, and we promise not to sell your details to any bigwig advertisers. The address is 4thestate.podomatic.com, or check out the website 4thestateradio.blogspot.com. And next week on the show, what started from humble beginnings is now boasting the title of the biggest event in the Southern Hemisphere. Why This Is Not Art came back from the dead and is looking better than ever. All Jack Sparrow jokes aside, could you be an accidental pirate? I find out on The Fourth Estate. My name's Mig Caldwell. I hope you can tune in with me next time.